Good morning. Well, my name is Evan. I work with our college students here, and it's just a privilege and a gift to be able to share with you this morning. I was reminded, hopefully this will come together, but as I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about this morning, I was reminded of the beginning of my marriage with Danielle. Before I came on full time here, I had the blessing and the opportunity to work out at Bluegrass Christian Camp in many different roles over the years. And one real gift of being on full-time staff there was that housing was provided. And so when Danielle and I got married, we got to move into the apartment that sits over the front room of the Mill Lodge building at camp, if you're familiar with the facilities there. And it's a great apartment. The building is old, and it's kind of cool. It's over 200 years old, actually, and the apartment has been updated, thankfully. And so in a lot of ways, it was the nicest residence on site at camp, but it was a really old building. And something I find to be true is that the longer a building stands, the more opportunity it gives nature to find a way in. And so, especially in the early months of our time living in the apartment, we dealt with some mice, and it drove us nuts. You know, every time we thought we got rid of them, more would show up. And mice, they're just punks, man. It feels like they're taunting you. It feels like they're taunting you because, like, you go into your kitchen and you can see where they've been. And it's like they leave evidence that they've been there, and they just make sure you know that they're around. And it was especially offensive to Danielle when one day she found some mouse droppings in our bedroom where we didn't have food. There was just a chair in the bedroom with some clothes on it, just a small pile of clothes, and there were mouse droppings on the clothes. And it's like, why'd you have to go there? There's no place you won't go to invade our space and make your presence known. And it just got old. And so our frustration with it kind of came to a peak one morning when Danielle gently woke me up and said, "Evan, there it is. It's on the chase. It's on the chair. It's right there." And it's like it was looking at us. You could see it. And it's like, I understand my role in this situation is to do something, and I don't know what. You know, I've never been quick, but even if mice are just quicker. And so I need to at least get this thing off the chair, hopefully get it out of the apartment, but I got to do something. And so I slowly get out of the bed, and I try to creep towards, and it's not moving. I don't think it's dead, but it's not moving. And that's really surprising to me because I've almost never seen a mouse as anything other than a blur in real life because they just zip by. And so I think I'm doing pretty well, but I know I'm not that sneaky. And I try to creep up on it, and it's still not moving. And I get a little closer and a little bit closer until I realize there's no mouse. There's no mouse on the chair. It was just a little divot in the pile of clothes and a shadow that was hitting it just right. I swear it looked just like a mouse, but a mouse it was not. And you know, that just made me think that in the right lighting, a simple divot can cause quite a disturbance. Or to say it another way, in the absence of good lighting, we can easily construct a false reality. You know, I've really come to enjoy the season of Advent and the way that it creates space to meditate on the wonder of the Christmas event. You know, Advent creates space to engage in faithful waiting. It creates space to remember what God has promised to do. Advent creates space to marvel at what God can do. And all of those things, they draw us back to the time before Jesus came as we lean into the spirit of Advent. These are things that help us to take to heart that we and the world need Jesus. And they build up our longing for Jesus. And so, you know, as over the past few years, especially embracing Advent, it changes my appreciation for Christmas. And it keeps Christ at the center of the season instead of the decorating, the shopping, the visiting family, the receiving gifts. But Advent also yields a greater sense of actual celebration for Christmas and what it truly is. Advent's anticipation makes the celebration of Christmas that much sweeter. And it helps Christ's light to shine a little more brightly in our eyes. And so this morning, now that we're on the other side of Advent, the other side of December 25th, I think it's appropriate for us to transition out of the anticipation of Advent and simply stand in this reality that Jesus has come. Jesus has come. And these are sweet words. They're sweeter than anything else we could think to say. These are words that restore faith in moments of doubt. These are words that bring hope in moments of despair. These are words that bring conviction in moments of selfishness. And these are words that bring joy in moments of sadness. Jesus has come. These words cast light over darkness, and they change the way that we see things. One of the texts that kind of inspired my thinking for this morning comes from Isaiah 2. This is kind of what inspired my title for this message. It reads, "The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shone." And this is prophecy for Christ's coming, his birth, his entrance into the world. Another thing that's really inspired me in thinking for this morning is a little book by Tim Keller. It's called Hidden Christmas, and it just has some great things to say about the gospel truths that show themselves through Jesus' birth. And Keller says in this book that the Christmas message is that on those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. And notice that it doesn't say from the world a light has dawned, but upon the world a light has dawned. It has come from the outside. There is light outside of this world, and Jesus has brought that light to save us. Indeed, he is the light. You know, in Jesus, here's what we come together this morning to recognize. We have seen a great light, a light that frees us from the false realities that feel so real in the darkness. And so I invite you all to spend a little time this morning reflecting with me on a few of the realities about the light that Jesus has brought into our world, the light that we can know all the better because Jesus has come into the world. One of the realities I want to stand in together this morning is that Jesus' light brings life. And we can ask ourselves a question, what's so life-giving about light? Well, for starters, without the sun, our planet's light source, none of us would be alive. And it's well known that a much greater percentage of people struggle with depression in parts of the earth that receive less sunlight. If we consider plants, we recognize that they can't live, let alone grow, unless they receive light. You know, for me, and I know I'm not alone in this, even if it's not true for everyone, all I need to do is think about how I feel on a sunny day as compared to a cloudy day. Because on a sunny day, I want to get outside. I want to feel the sun's warmth. I want to be active. I want to share it with someone else. But on a cloudy day, I just want to stay in and sleep. There's no better day for a nap than a cloudy day. And in fact, we're just as likely to call such a day gloomy instead of cloudy. Because with the sun's light obscured the day, it's just not as warm or as inviting. And it makes sleep seem a lot more desirable and natural. And so I may be no less alive, but I'm much less interested in doing much living. There's just something true in this about God's design. And this principle at work in God's design for creation, it represents a bigger truth. Just as creation needs the sun's light to live and to thrive, we need God's light to live and thrive. And the very first command that we see God speaking over creation in Genesis is this: let there be light. Before people, before animals on the land, in the air, in the sea, before the stars, before the plants, before dry land and waters, even before the sky, light was the very first thing that God saw fit to speak into the universe. And Scripture points us to God as our life source, not just in the sense that he creates us and pushes the on button, but also in the sense that he is continually and constantly our life source. Scripture frequently references God's light as the element from which we receive this life. We see in Psalm 36:9, "For with you is the fountain of life, in your light do we see light." We see in John 1, verses 4 and 5, speaking of Jesus, "In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." Darkness, of course, is the absence of light. And darkness is something that we're familiar with, even attracted to, but without fail, darkness proves itself to be a life drainer, not a life giver. And what do we see here as the reason that darkness has not overcome the light? Because the light shines in the darkness. And so what's so life-giving, truly life-giving, about the fact that Jesus Christ was born? Well, if you've watched or read any remarkable stories about survival, you've probably come across the sentiment that living is about a lot more than just breathing, right? Life is about a lot more than plain existence. And although, make no mistake, Jesus gets sole credit for our very existence, but God was bringing people into existence well before the incarnation of Jesus Christ. And so this is what we can know with absolute confidence. The birth of Jesus Christ is truly, deeply, incomparably life-giving because of the milestone that it marks in God's pursuit of humanity. The light shines in the darkness. Jesus was life before he took on flesh, and Jesus was light before he took on flesh. But what's life-giving about his birth is the truth that communicates to us about how near he is willing to come to us with his light of life so that we might seek to stay in it. And when we stay in Jesus' light, we can come to know it and possess life everlasting, which is what we see in Jesus' statement that he is the light of the world, and whoever follows him will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of light. You see, Jesus took on flesh and stepped into darkness so that he could come near to humanity and say quite literally, "Follow me. Walk with me. Enter the light of my life and stay in it with me." Tim Keller has this to say about it. "According to the Bible, we have lost the original, full, right relationship with God we had at the beginning. That is the reason we will eventually know physical death, and it is why we experience spiritual death now. Loss of meaning and hope, addictive, inordinate desires, deep discontent that can't be satisfied, shame and struggles with identity, and an inability to change." And we ask ourselves, how many of us find our life in Christ, but still struggle with some of these aspects of spiritual death? How many of us feel a loss of meaning and hope, addictive, inordinate desires, and these other things that he mentions? You know, the problem is not that we need to try harder. The problem is that we look to things other than Jesus to give life. We look to substances, we look to relationships, we look to our own strength, whatever it may be. But none of those things can substitute Christ's light of life. But because Jesus came, we can walk with him and we can come to know his light. And we can come to know his light not only as an external source of life, but as our very own essence, the defining quality of who we are. And I see this truth coming through in Ephesians 5, 8 through 10. "For at one time you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true, and try to discern what is pleasing to the Lord." So we find our life and the defining quality of it in Jesus' light. Another truth we want to look at this morning is that Jesus' light brings truth. And we ask, what's light's relationship to truth? Well, without light, we can't see things for what they really are. You think about the fact that no matter how well you know a road, you know better than to do much driving in the dark without your headlights on. And if you spend enough time in a dark room, you might be able to learn its layout, but you'll never really know what's in it until you bring it under the light. You can sense texture, but not text. You can sense shape, but not color. You can sense size, but not substance. And another thing is that your eyes start to play tricks on you in the dark. You lose sense of what's real. And sometimes it can be hard to tell what's a mouse and what's just a divot in the shadows. And this is why we need light, and God's light specifically. We see in Psalms 119 that the unfolding of God's words gives light. It imparts understanding to the simple. You know, we need God's light in order to understand things well. And that understanding comes only through spending time with the Lord, spending time in His Word, turning His words over, and truly unfolding His words, because it is inside of God's words that we will find light and truth. But how likely are we to go to someone else, something else, as our source of truth? How frequently do we refine our sense of truth without looking to Christ? And what outside of Christ are we allowing to form our sense of what's true? You know, we live in a dark, loud world that seeks to make sense of itself. And it's a world that has little interest in finding truth in Jesus' light. But it is greatly interested in selling us on the way it's come to see things. And it can be convincing, even consuming, to listen to the world's accounts of how things are. But to do so is to allow a false sense of truth to steal our joy and even our identity. Thinking about this truth, Martin Luther King Jr. preached this. He said, as Christians, we must never surrender our supreme loyalty to any time-bound custom or earth-bound idea. For at the heart of our universe is a higher reality, God and His kingdom of love, to which we must be conformed. Instead of being formed by earthly voices, and make no mistake, we are formed by the voices that we subscribe to, let us be conformed to God's kingdom and its light. Proverbs 14:8 tells us that the wisdom of the prudent is to discern his way. We have to be mindful of whether we're on a path of goodness and truth. Psalms 119:105 tells us, your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. Jesus lights the way. And by subjecting himself to becoming human and being born into the world, Jesus brings his light and exposes the darkness's biggest lies. And he not only exposes the lies, but he also reveals the truths that are so easily obscured in darkness. Ephesians 5 speaks to this. It says, take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. For it is shameful even to speak of the things that they do in secret. But when anything is exposed by the light, it becomes visible. For anything that becomes visible is light. You know, throughout this world, throughout this country, even throughout the church, we're witnessing an eroding sense of value for objective truth. And I think most of us would agree with that statement. And this shouldn't be surprising to any of us, because Satan's game from the very beginning has been to distort the truth. And he's killing that game right now. But it's amazing how a fundamental idea can have such a formative effect on a person. It's amazing how a fundamental idea can have such a formative effect on a person. You know, I'm reminded of the movie Inception, in which a team of operatives invades a man's dreams in order to plant one idea deep down into his psyche. And they're tasked to do this because planting this one idea, it will drastically and predictably changed that man's course of action. I just think there's something true about that. And we need to ask ourselves, what fundamental ideas inhabit our psyches, guiding our actions, and how might they be affected when exposed to the light of Christ? How does the light of Christ's coming, draw truth out of the ideas the world has fed me? It might go like this. The world would have us believe that somebody's always out to get us. Well, Jesus would have us believe that he is for us. The world would have us believe that we're perfectly capable of saving ourselves. But Jesus would have us believe that we need him and we can trust him to give us all that we need. The world would have us believe that our worth is tied up in blessings we don't deserve or achievements that we can't keep up with. But Jesus would have us believe that we are worth dying for just as we are. And you know, even if there's some truth to be found in the ideas that the world gives us, not all truths are created equal. And God's truths are just bigger. Tim Keller speaks to this. He says, "We fear rejection and failure, but if you were completely filled with God's love, you would not care what people thought. We fear the future and circumstances, but if you knew God perfectly and that he is good and in control, you would trust him. And you wouldn't be afraid of death because you would know you'd be with him forever." These words, they're not meant to bring guilt or shame. They're not meant to chastise us for falling short of what they claim. Rather, these words echo Jesus' invitations to come, to follow me and to come and see. And so the question isn't whether rejection, failure, risk, and death are real. Of course, they're real. They're very real. And knowing God doesn't change the fact that these are real. The question, though, is how does God transcend these realities? And then the question is, how do we come to trust God's reign as the greatest reality? How do we trust God to overshadow any other circumstances, experience, or truths that we experience? John Piper tells us this. The meaning of Christmas is not only that God replaces shadow with reality, but also that he takes the reality and makes it real to his people. He writes it on our hearts. He does not lay his Christmas gift of salvation and transformation down for you to pick up in your own strength. He picks it up and puts it in your heart and in your mind and seals to you that you are a child of God. Because Jesus has come, it makes it that much more real to us that God's truth stands taller than anything else the world might tell us. The last truth we want to look at is that Jesus' life brings beauty. You know, one thing that always impresses me about photographers is how well they understand lighting. Because light does so much more than provide visibility. It can be used to build warmth or to portray a certain mood. And to get the perfect image, you've got to get the lighting right. Because beauty is revealed by the way that light is present. And one thing we're all aware of is how light can sometimes be too bright for us to take the picture we want. And when that happens, the light dictates the story that the picture tells. In a way, this is what Jesus does by being born into the world. He enters our story and shines so brightly that he becomes the focus of the story. But with Jesus, it's not about his being jealous for the spotlight. It's not about him forcing himself upon us. It's about shining light into darkness and revealing true beauty, because we can be so misguided by our sense of beauty when left to our own devices. Here's the truth that we can cling to. God is beautiful, and Jesus reminds us of that. And he's more than beautiful. He's glorious. 2 Corinthians tells us that God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And this is such an interesting statement to me. One thing that comes to mind for me is in Isaiah 53, where it tells us that Jesus had no form or majesty that we should look at him, no beauty that we should desire him. We're told that Jesus wouldn't be a visually striking man, at least in the conventional sense. But in Jesus' face dwelled the glory of God. And those who had authentic encounters with Jesus and his plain face probably never witnessed greater beauty than when they stood before him. And why? Why is that? Because the glory of God dwelled in that face. And Jesus likewise abided. He dwelled in his Father's presence. When something, when someone is brought into God's light and it chooses to dwell in the light rather than scatter like a cockroach, God will reveal the beauty that he's had in mind since he created it. Nothing is plain when it carries the glory of God. Nothing is plain when it carries the glory of God. Tim Keller says, he advises us, don't be put off by the ordinariness of the means of joy. For in that ordinariness is hidden the extraordinary riches of the gospel. Recall that light reveals things for what they really are. Therefore, light reveals the beauty of things because God makes beautiful things. And by coming near to us in plain flesh, Jesus reveals the divine beauty of his glory. And then he causes us to see everything in light of that beauty. And then he works in us to take his light and reveal his beauty throughout the world. And those of us who are convinced of Christ's beauty recognize the only way to discover the world's true beauty is to view it in light of God's glory. You know, one more quote to share here. It's from Esau McCulley. He says, Jesus asks us to see the brokenness in society and to articulate an alternative vision for how we might live. This does not mean that we believe that we can establish the kingdom on earth before his second coming. It does mean that we see society for what it is, less than the kingdom. We let the world know that we see the cracks in the facade. And I don't share this quote to be negative. I share this quote because I think that we need it. I think that we need it. We need to be aware that unless we're immersing ourselves in God's beauty with God's kingdom people, unless we're doing that, what we see happening around us does not reflect the Lord. And we can't allow ourselves to settle for anything less than Christ's beauty. So we call out the cracks that we see in the world's facade, but that's not enough. We also articulate an alternative vision for how we might live. And that's Christmas. That's Christmas. That's the beauty of Jesus' birth. The author of life, truth, and beauty, the one with the ultimate vision for how we might live, he lowers himself and steps into the mess. He steps right into the mess that he might give us a better way. And that better way is with him. He came because he wants us to be with him. And because of that, we can discover beauty in any person, any place, any circumstance. All creation bears the fingerprints of the one creator. And one has come who can help us to see it. He helps us to see that nothing else gives light like he does. He becomes the only light that we come to recognize, as we see in this passage from Isaiah. God promises this. He says, the sun shall no more be your light by day, nor for brightness shall the moon give you light, but the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your God will be your glory. Your sun shall no more go down, nor your moon withdraw itself, for the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your days of mourning shall be ended. Pray with me.